Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 20th of January, these are our main stories. The Hollywood star Alec Baldwin is being charged with involuntary manslaughter over the fatal shooting of a cinematographer on a Western film set. European nations have promised new military aid packages for Ukraine to help it recapture territory and fend off any further Russian offensives. The US Treasury says it's taking emergency action to avoid a default after the US government reached its debt limit. Also in this podcast, Japan forces big companies to hire more disabled people. And unheard since World War II.
Quoi qu'il arrive, la flamme de la résistance française.
Bringing back to life General de Gaulle's BBC wartime broadcast. Back in 2021, the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin was rehearsing a scene for his Western, Rust, when the film's cinematographer was shot with a prop gun he'd been using. Helena Hutchins died on the set in the state of New Mexico. Alec Baldwin is now facing a charge of involuntary manslaughter, as is the film's armourer. More from our correspondent David Willis in Los Angeles.
Well, we've heard, Alex, from the district attorney for Santa Fe in New Mexico, Mary Carmack Altwees, and she has said in an interview in cable television here that there was, in her view, a sense of complacency on the set of this film, Rust. And she said that it amounts to negligence that rises to recklessness, hence the levelling of these charges, involuntary manslaughter, against both the armourer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, and the actor-producer, Alec Baldwin. Miss Carmack Altwees said that there was, in her view, a lack of safety standards on the set, including live rounds mixed in with regular dummy rounds that weren't being checked. Somehow, one of those live rounds got loaded into a gun. That got handed to Alec Baldwin, who also didn't check the gun before firing. And she described it as a fast and loose set in which nobody was doing their job. She said that three people, David Halls, the first assistant director, Alec Baldwin and Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, had they been doing their basic duties, Helena Hutchinson, the cinematographer, would still be alive today.
What's the reaction been to the charges?
Well, Alec Baldwin's lawyers have issued a defiant statement, Alec, saying the decision represents, in their words, a terrible miscarriage of justice. And that statement goes on to say Mr. Baldwin had no reason to believe there was a live bullet in the gun or anywhere on the movie set. He relied on professionals with whom he worked who assured him that the gun did not have live rounds. That statement concludes, "We will fight these charges and we will win." And the armourer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, through her lawyer, has said that she did not commit involuntary manslaughter. These charges are the result of a very flawed investigation and an inaccurate understanding of the full facts. We intend to bring the full truth to light and believe that Hannah will be exonerated of wrongdoing.
But if Alec Baldwin were convicted, the penalties are, well, very serious.
Both defendants are facing the possibility of 18 months in prison, Alex, if convicted. Charges are expected to be filed before the end of this month, and it's possible that it will be 2 months or so before the case goes to trial. We're looking at a trial in the springtime, and of course there will be a lot of evidence brought by people who were on the set at the time, including, it's thought, David Halls, the man I just referred to, the first assistant director, who has signed a plea deal with prosecutors, presumably in order for them to paint some sort of picture of what they perceive as the disregard for normal safety standards that existed on the set of this film, Rust.
David Willis in Los Angeles. Next to Estonia, the smallest of the Baltic states, where there were some very big pledges on Thursday of more arms for Ukraine. At a meeting in the north of Estonia, 9 nations, including Britain, Poland and Sweden, all promised to make further significant deliveries to Kyiv. Estonia itself promised to give more than 1% of its GDP in military assistance, a figure running into hundreds of millions of dollars. Kaja Kallas is the Estonian Prime Minister.
As the war is going on, we haven't done enough. Russia has not been weakened. Russia has tripled its military industry to produce more. They have more people that are mobilized or could be mobilized. Therefore, we should be prepared for the long haul, and we should give Ukraine all the military help that they need.
Later today, Friday, there'll be a much larger gathering when around 50 countries meet in Germany to discuss the same issue. Key will be a difficult decision from the Germans, whether to become only the second country after Britain to pledge tanks to Ukraine. And as if to make clear just what's possibly at stake, Moscow has once again given a strong warning to the West on sending arms that could be used to strike Russia. Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president, warned of the danger of nuclear war should Russia be defeated. Another ally of President Putin is Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church.
This desire to defeat Russia today has taken on, as we know, very dangerous forms. We pray to the Lord that he will enlighten those madmen and help them understand that any desire to destroy Russia will mean the end of the world.
Just how significant, then, are the pledges made in Estonia? A question for our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, who's there.
Well, I think it's essentially a coalition of the willing, mostly, who've been meeting here in Estonia, and I think designed to step up the pressure before that crucial meeting in Ramstein, which will involve more countries. Now, they have said, they've given specific pledges. You mentioned Estonia, 1% of its GDP it's spending on supporting Ukraine militarily, but they have also said in a statement, a joint statement at the end, that we commit to collectively pursuing delivery of an unprecedented set of donations, including main battle tanks, heavy artillery, air defence ammunition and infantry fighting vehicles. Now, some of these are going to be given, but the sticking point is the main battle tank. Britain's committed to sending 14 of its Challenger 2 battle tanks. It's the Leopard tank that's made in Germany that is most ubiquitous in Europe, operated by a number of armies in Europe. But the Germans would need to give their approval, even for allies to send those tanks to Ukraine, and Poland's been keen to do that. Sweden's indicated it might as well. But without German approval, that can't happen.
And very strong and scary words coming out of Moscow.
Yes, but I think, you know, we've had that, haven't we, throughout the war. We've had warnings from Moscow every time a new weapon system is sent. And it was similar to when HIMARS, those long-range rockets, were sent. There was a clear warning from Moscow. I think the view amongst Western military officials I've spoken to is that there is now a window of opportunity, possibly this spring, to push Russia back, to go on the offensive, to retake, for Ukraine to retake the territories Russia has taken. And if they allow more time for Russia to rebuild its forces, then that becomes harder. So I think there is a sense of urgency. It's taken them a year to deliver the first main battle tanks, but there is now a belief that they've got to do more to help Ukraine go on the offence. The focus, defensive weapons, has changed. All weapons can be used offensively or defensively, but the belief amongst many allies is that main battle tanks will be key to giving Ukraine success in the battlefield and breaking the deadlock.
Jonathan Beale. If Ukraine's Western allies need an illustration of why Kyiv says it requires more arms, they have only to look at the eastern city of Soledar. Ukrainian soldiers have told the BBC they've now withdrawn from there, confirming Russia's first significant victory in months. Despite that, Ukrainian troops on the front line remain upbeat, as our correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
We're driving along back roads now, heading up towards the front, close to Soledar, where some of the heaviest fighting has been taking place here. The Russians have taken the town and are hoping to advance closer on Bakhmut, which I can see in the distance there. We're going to a forward brigade of paratroopers, assault group. Also have a lot of artillery and rockets. So much Ukrainian armour around me here. Hear the booms outside, artillery outgoing. We're speeding up now, going across a stretch of exposed territory in view of the Russians, just a couple of kilometres away off to the left.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's incoming.
You're getting out?
It's incoming. A lot of incoming.
Taking cover for a bit. Incoming artillery, not that far away. Very close to Soledar, seized by the Russians in the last few days. The Ukrainians have withdrawn, but they're now trying to pound the Russian positions as hard as they can to prevent them from advancing here and encircling the next bigger prize, which is the town of Bakhmut, which the Ukrainians have been defending fiercely for months. Sheltering now in a ditch just off the road. Okay, we're off on foot. Okay, saying quick, let's go. Clambering through the remains of a house here, hit by a shell. Heading towards the Ukrainian position. A small cottage. What can we call you?
My name is Andrei.
Andrei. What is the situation here?
Fine. We are fighting and we are... It's war. It's war. It's 1 kilometer. About 1 mile.
1 mile from the Russian positions?
Yeah, about one.
You can hear that automatic gunfire?
Yeah. 1 mile. It's quite...
Quite close.
Yeah.
But you've lost territory here. You've lost Soledar.
We have quite tough situation here, so... But it's controlled situation anyway. And anyway, I believe in my commander. Sometimes it's really better to take step back but destroy enemy than after that to make attack and already crush enemy completely.
So that's
and
the plan,
now
the counter
situation. Attack, yeah, we have this controlled situation. We are destroying each day 50, 100 enemy people.
You're losing a lot of men too.
Yeah? Anyway, less. Final result will be, a victory for us,
Okay, that was a mortar going off just behind us from these positions. Let's go.
Okay, guys, thank you very much.
Thanks, we go. Okay, we're off. Straight down to the main road. Very exposed, but we can turn right and we can hopefully get out of trouble quickly.
Andrew Harding on the front line near Soledar. The Japanese government is making large companies hire more disabled staff. It comes as a recent investigation found that some were filling their hiring quotas by employing disabled people on various farms around Japan. Will Leonardo reports.
By 2026, Japanese firms will have to show that 2.7% of their workforce have a disability, up from 2.3%. But a recent investigation by the Kyodo News Agency involving the Labour Ministry has highlighted how some appear to be getting around quotas. It found that around 800 companies, most without links to agriculture, were renting farms around Japan and staffing them with thousands of disabled people. The produce was then being handed out to other employees. Although it still results in gainful employment, disability advocacy groups have urged the government to close the loophole. They say it allows companies to avoid the hard task of adjusting their work practices.
Will Leonardo. It's a moment immortalised in French history books. General de Gaulle's 1940 broadcast on the BBC urging the people of France to resist the Nazi occupation. It's not been possible to listen to the speech, as there's no recording, but 21st century technology has changed this, as Rebecca Wood reports.
Artificial intelligence is developing at a lightning speed. It's now even being used to recreate lost moments in history. It was from here, BBC Broadcasting House in London, that Charles de Gaulle, the leader of Free France and later the country's president, gave a speech appealing to the French people to resist Nazi Germany's occupation. The date was the 18th of June 1940, and it turned out to be one of the most famous speeches in French history. But surprisingly, no recording of it appears to exist. Charles-Henri Gru is a journalist from the newspaper Le Monde.
There is a lot of mystery around it. We do not know with certainty at what time it was pronounced. We do not know why it was pronounced on this day. We do not know why it was not recorded. We do not know almost anything about it.
He's made it his mission to bring de Gaulle's speech back to life after unearthing an original transcript sitting in the archives of Swiss military intelligence.
As we were discovering new things about this speech, there was a remaining question. How did it sound? Can we hear it as if we were in 1940?
And this is where artificial intelligence came in. The journalist needed three ingredients. First, the transcript. Then, de Gaulle's voice.
Il est temps que dans cet accord des actes.
This is a recording by the BBC of a different speech by the general during the Second World War. And the third ingredient, an actor who could add authenticity to the recreated speech. Then, with the help of audio experts in Paris to bring it all together, we have the final result. De Gaulle declaring, whatever happens, the flame of French resistance must not and will not be extinguished.
Quoi qu'il arrive. La flamme de la résistance française ne doit pas s'éteindre et ne s'éteindra pas.
Brought to life, the words of the 49-year-old general calling on France to keep on fighting.
Demain, comme aujourd'hui, je parlerai à la radio de Londres.
Rebecca Wood. Still to come, scientists say light pollution has massively reduced the number of stars visible from most countries.
Anybody who's involved in such a lighting decision has the opportunity to choose a light that illuminates the area only that's needed, rather than shining sort of sideways in all directions.
And what we can do to combat it. The US Treasury says it's taking extraordinary measures after the federal government reached its borrowing limit of $31.4 trillion to pay its debts. These technical measures will help prevent America defaulting for the first time, but only until June. This will buy time for Congress to decide either to raise the debt limit or suspend it altogether. But there's likely to be a standoff between President Biden and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. So, why has the limit been reached? Samira Hussain is our North America business correspondent.
In this particular case, I think, you know, some of the policies that have been put in place by U.S. President Joe Biden, there are some that are suggesting that it's this student loan forgiveness that has really pushed the U.S. a bit closer to that debt ceiling or crossing that debt ceiling faster than it would have anticipated. So the economic impacts could be really quite severe, and especially would come at a time when already the United States is, you know, looking at possibly entering into a recession. We're already talking about several American companies that are reporting earnings that are much lower than what investors were expecting. We're seeing that companies are starting to lay off thousands of staff. So this kind of uncertainty doesn't come at a very good time. It's never a good time, but it's a particularly delicate time for the American economy. I think a lot of reasons why people are so worried about this particular instance is because Congress is just so divided, and you have such really strong factions within Congress that are going to fight tooth and nail to try and get what they want and use the debt ceiling as that tool.
Samira Hussain. The European Parliament has called for Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guards to be designated as a terrorist entity. The Parliament has only an advisory role, but the move will now be considered by the EU's executive branch. Khasra Naji from BBC Persian reports.
The European Parliament voted overwhelmingly to call for the inclusion of Iran's Revolutionary Guard in the bloc's list of terrorist organizations. The vote came in reaction to the Guard's role in the violent crackdown on protesters in Iran in recent months, for the execution of protesters, and for its role in supplying Russia with military drones that are being used in the war in Ukraine. Iran's president has reacted by saying it's a desperate move by the enemies of Iran.
Khasra Naji. If you've been scouring the night sky in vain for your favourite constellation, there may be a good reason. The sky is getting brighter. Data collected by citizen scientists, amateur stargazers to you and me, has found that the stars are disappearing in front of our eyes because of light pollution coming from Earth. Dr. Christopher Kaiber from the German Research Centre for Geosciences ran the study over a 12-year period and collated its results.
So people went out at night and they looked at the sky and they compared it to a set of star charts that were provided to them by Globe at Night that show what the constellations look like under different levels of light pollution. So for Orion, in a big city, you might only see the three belt stars, whereas out in the countryside, you might see a whole bunch of stars sort of in Orion's body. And by selecting which one of those maps best matches the sky, and then providing us your location and the time you made the observation, we get an idea about how many stars you can see. And what we found is that over the years, people are reporting that they're able to see fewer and fewer stars. We were able then to use a model to try and explain this data by an increase in sky brightness, and we found that we could explain it really well with a global increase of about 10% per year.
And what is causing that?
We don't actually know what types of light are responsible for it. You know, cities know about the streetlights they have, but there's no public databases of things like lights on the sides of people's houses, buildings, the display windows from shops, and illuminated bridges and things like that. So we know that there are new lights being installed, but we can't really talk about how, or we don't know about, you know, what they are.
Other than meaning that we can see fewer stars, far fewer stars than we could a few years ago. What are the other negative impacts then of this?
Well, for me, this sky brightness is sort of a visual representation of waste. It shows that the way that we're lighting the city is really inefficient. So we're all paying for that either as taxpayers for public lighting that's not done well, or as customers for private lighting and advertising lighting that's not well done. It's also a sign that we're using a whole lot more energy than is necessary for producing this light, or for producing the light that we need in the city. And that energy is often being generated by coal, for example, which is then producing air pollution and also CO2 emissions. So the sky brightness by itself is a problem, but it also indicates that most likely the ecological impacts of light pollution, this is now direct light shining onto plants or animals, are probably also increasing, because if we're seeing more light in the sky, it's very likely that there's also more light on the ground.
Is there anything individuals can do?
Yeah, absolutely, because in a big city like London, for example, there's probably millions of people that are making lighting decisions. So these are shop owners that are deciding what kind of a sign to put up, what hours to illuminate it, and homeowners that are putting up lights to illuminate their porch or steps outside or things like that. So anybody who's involved in such a lighting decision has the opportunity to choose a light that illuminates the area only that's needed, rather than shining sort of sideways in all directions, and also to choose a brightness that's appropriate. So when you make one area extraordinarily bright, everywhere else is going to look dark in comparison. So it's better to sort of try and match the surroundings and choose a relatively conservative light, we can say, rather than choosing something that's making your porch really, really bright and everything else around it look dark.
Dr. Christopher Kaiber talking to James Kumarasamy. China's internet censor believes the country has a problem with social media personalities glorifying prison life. It's even worried that young people could start committing crimes in order to experience life behind bars. The BBC's China media analyst Kerry Allen has been following the story.
Well, there's been this announcement by the Cyberspace Administration of China, which is the internet regulator in the country, saying that there's going to be a cleanup campaign because it started to observe people who are gaining a following on social media platforms who are talking about their experience of prison life. And this is very unusual, which is probably why they're starting to appear and very quickly amass followers. So one outlet, the Lychee News online news website, has said that one example, the prodigal son who came home, has managed to amass 87,000 followers in a short space of time because he has been talking about his experiences in prison.
But why would anyone want to glorify the experience of life in a Chinese prison? It sounds one of the worst places you could be, surely.
Well, absolutely. But this is what the state is quite concerned about, that where is this person and other ex-prisoners are talking about the lessons they've learned and the way that they want to reform themselves. The government is concerned that they are using, as newspapers are writing, their special experience to gain traffic and make money. And so they are expressing concern via newspapers that people might actually find prison life glamorous and see it as a way that they could potentially, you know, if they spend a short period of time in prison, then can have a niche in the online influencer industry.
But they're suggesting that people would try and get themselves jailed just so that they can join this trend.
Absolutely, yes, or even lie about their experiences. And as one newspaper puts it, hype up bad deeds. So try and use this, say that they've done something bad, lie, in order to gain traffic.
Life in a Chinese jail, though, is pretty awful, isn't it?
It is, but you do in China have short administrative punishments, and these can be for small acts, be they drunken, disorderly, or acts like this. But generally, it is very difficult to know what happens inside a Chinese prison. And so for an online influencer to appear on a social media platform talking about their experiences, it is fascinating to Chinese people.
Cleanup campaigns are not uncommon around the Lunar New Year, are they?
They're not. No, not at all. It's normally this time when you'll hear of cleanup campaigns from the Cyberspace Administration of China. And this is not the only thing that's being cleared up. I mean, one thing you have to understand with the Chinese internet is that there are thousands of moderators who remove content that they see as subversive, but also in an attempt to, as they see, keep the internet pure. So you do get anyway a lot of anti-government messages that on a regular basis, but very much around the Lunar New Year, get wiped from the internet. But yeah, this is very new. I've never heard of something like this before, that prison influencers, it's decided there needs to be a crackdown here because it considers that their influence might be harmful to online audiences.
Kerry Allen. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Rowan Madison, and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MY-HP or click below.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos, and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.